Today's guest is someone whose name is practically synonymous with musical theater, none other than Sir Cameron McIntosh. Les Mis, Miss Saigon, Phantom, Mary Poppins. These are just a handful of the hundreds of shows Cameron has produced over the years. He is currently at work bringing successful revivals of Cats as well as Miss Saigon back to the States. In full disclosure, Cameron was the producer for two of my shows written with John Dempsey, The Fix at the Donmar Warehouse in 1997, and The Witches of Eastwick, which ran on London's West End from 2000 to 2001. Cameron joins me by phone today from his office in London. Let's find out what makes him tick and how his passion for musical theater has taken him to the top.
Sir Cameron McIntosh, thank you so much for talking with me today.
It's a pleasure, Dana, and it's Cameron.
It's Cameron, I know,
yes.
But you know...
Only my mother's interested.
It's really fun to say Sir Cameron, though, I have to say. You know, how many times do I get to say that to people that I know and love? So, listen, I'm going to get right to it. When you were a child, what was your favorite book?
A child?
Yes.
My favorite book. Oh, my yeah. God. I don't know if I actually was reading books. I mean, my first memory of reading was actually reading the newspaper. I was notorious to be able, at the age of four, to read a newspaper. You know, I was always quite a fast reader. So I simply, I didn't have a childhood book that turned into a musical. Andrew did, but I did the musical with Cats. With T.S. Eliot. I mean, you know, Andrew was brought up in T.S. Eliot, and some of the people were brought up on Beatrix Potter, and other people were brought up on, you know, Peter Pan. So I just didn't, because, I mean, you know, by the time I was eight, I had decided that I was going to be a producer of musicals. And through seeing a musical called Salad Days, which was the big new hit that happened in 1954. So after that, I only sort of read up about musicals and the theater. That's all I wanted to do throughout my life. And luckily, I managed it. I'm not sure I managed to grow up, though, but certainly managed to keep on doing musicals.
Well, that's so incredible to know at such an early age what it is your heart wants to do, what you want to do as a person.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't realize until I was in my mid-20s how lucky I was. Most people don't have, you know, that knowledge of themselves, and they drift into things, but it's a great, great blessing to know what you want to do, and even a greater blessing to be able to continue doing it.
Indeed. As a person who has produced many of the world's most beloved and successful musicals, if you could play any role, any gender, any age, any vocal range, what would it be, Cameron McIntosh?
Well, I think there's a bit of Mary Poppins inside me, as you know very well.
You're practically perfect.
As I bossily interfere into everything, go spit spot. Let's get this done.
one of my most favorite remembrances of working with you is I said, well, we're working on a demo of something and we're going to send it to you tomorrow. And you said, well, if you were to play it for me, what might it sound like? It was such a wonderful way of just saying, no, I want to hear it now. So Mary Poppins.
There's a bit of Mary Poppins. And the other bit, it's also another Cockney musical, funny enough, because I do love the Britishness in a lot of musicals I do. I mean, I've always thought with a little bit of luck is a wonderful philosophy to have in life. You know, you need to be a little smart and everything, but we all need a little bit of luck. And I think that's buoyed me through my life.
Fantastic. You realize at a very early age what you wanted to do. What action did you take to make that dream a reality?
Well, the person who'd written the musical that turned me on to wanting to be a producer was a young English composer called Julian Slade, and by the second time I'd been to see the show, I'd worked out that Julian Slade was playing the piano in the pit, and he was the one that, when I went up at the end of the show to talk to him, took me backstage and sort of lit that moment when I decided what I wanted to do. And he remained a great friend of mine all the way through school. And when I was leaving through school, and I was asking advice about how I got into the theatre, he did what a lot of people would do, which is say, well, you know, theatre is quite tricky. Why don't you go to university, get a degree, then you'll have something to fall back on. I took as supportive advice, and I went, okay, but I'll only do it if I could get into a university that had a drama course, and there were only two in those days, and in fact I went up for both of them, but my A levels, you know, were not actually of a high enough standard to actually get in, because everybody wanted to get into them. So I went out of I'll go to a drama school, and I managed to get into a very good drama school, Central School of Speech and Drama. But they had a very strict guy running the stage management course, which is what I was on, and he sort of thought you had to be very, very strict and, shout at people a lot, whereas I found it was much easier to get people to do what you want to be rather charming and sweet to them. And, of course, I got on my shows quite happily, but he didn't really approve. And after a year, he said, I can't teach you anything, and you don't seem to be at all interested in Euripides. And I went, no, the only Greek subject I was interested in was the boys from Syracuse. Which has lovely music by Richard Rodgers. He said, I think you should leave. And I left. And I sort of, I've always loved having holidays. So I was having my family holiday in August. I was lying on the beach thinking, oh, now what am I going to do? I want to be a producer. I'm going to have to get myself a job. So I got, I didn't have any money. So when I got back to London, I sort of rather arrogantly picked up the Evening Standard and decided I would go and knock on the doors of all the theatres in London to see if there were any stagehand jobs. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it shows how arrogant I was, because 16th down the list of theatres that I thought I might deign to give my presence was Camelot, the original production of Camelot at Drury Lane, which of course I should have gone first, because in fact it had the biggest set and the biggest amount of stagehands there. Sure. So luckily I did go down. I'd seen the show and I wasn't entirely happy with it. which is why it was 16th on the list of places I was going to try. So I did go there, and I was literally being turned away by the stage doorman, and someone chased out after me, the prop master, saying, I hear you're looking for a job. We've got a temporary job for 2 weeks while someone's on holiday. Mm-hmm. And that's how it started. And in fact, I got £7 a week for doing that. And I think what clinched it is that I'd agree to do the matinees, because a lot of the stagehands didn't want to do the matinees. So I managed to do that. And I used to clean the theatre in the morning to get another £7 a week. And I would go in and clean the dress circle and everything like that. Though I was always terrible at getting up in the morning, and I used to have a friend there who would put the Hoover on in one of the big salons and close the door as if I was hoovering it. And when I was leaving 4 months later to go and become an ASM on Oliver, an acting ASM on Oliver, George Hoare, the legendary manager of this theatre, went, Cameron, we wish you every success with your career, because everybody had been bending their ears saying I was going to be a producer. He said, and by the way, he said, I've always known that it was not you switching on the Hoover at 7 o'clock in the morning. and that's how I started. And as I say, then became an acting ASM on Oliver and on the original tour of that brilliant original production. And how weird it is that not only the theatre I rehearse in I now own, but also the show. And on that tour was when I met Lionel Bart, because I was And I was quite pretty in those days, and I was sort of, and I'd been an SM on it, and literally on the first night in Manchester, at the old Opera House, I was at the stage, I was at the sort of pastel when Lionel was coming through to go and see the actors backstage, and, you know, he was legendary, and you know, the height of his fame at that point, and he went, "Hello, son," he said, "tell me, what do you do?" And I said, "Well, I'm in the show, I'm acting SM." He said, "Well, what do you want to do in the future?" I said, "I want to put on wonderful musicals like this, Mr. Bard." He said, "Well, good luck, my son." And that was how I first met him.
Fantastic. Along the way, you just had such focus and such knowledge of what you want to do. You also have incredible taste and a knack for knowing what is good, you know, whereas some people kind of waffle on that. What do you attribute that to?
Well, it's interesting. You know, my talent is not to come up with good. As you know, when we worked on Witches of Eastwick, I obviously want, having been introduced to you, I mean, what with the fix, you know, which I love doing, I just want you to get on working. But as you know, I didn't tell you what to write. I just wanted you to write something. You both chose going to do Witches of Eastwick. Right. It was one of a list of titles that I thought I might be able to get for the rights for you. Mm-hmm. But you unerringly with John went for that title. And it's the same with my entire career. I have never come up with anything more original than doing Song and Dance with Andrew, which was, you know, a sort of theatrical pairing of two of his existing works. And because that isn't my talent. My talent is to spot something which has already been inspired by the authors have been inspired to write, and then beat them over the head to make it as good as it possibly can be. And it's because I'm a chameleon, you know, and I work with a lot of very, very different kinds of writers, from Sondheim to Andrew to you to Anthony and George Stiles, you know, and Anthony Drew, and you know, I love doing that. And I do manage, once I know what the style is and that you're all writing, I sort of manage to lock on to that style, and as if I'm only doing that kind of show. But all of the shows that I've been done, you know, whether they've been successes or failures, that there's one interesting thing in hindsight that they all have. Nearly every single piece that I'm attracted to has the source material has been a great classic writer, whether it be Dickens or Hugo, Herman Melville, John Updike, Pamela Travers. You know, they're all great works which for some reason have ignited something in the writers to want to do something with and create something new out of something existing. And you know, I love that, and that's what I get it, that's what I'm immersed in, which is why I get just as much satisfaction in a way of going back to a great musical that I didn't do originally. You know, and of course, Oliver's one of those, cause, you know, I didn't create it. And My Fair Lady is the other one that I regularly go back to. I love My Fair Lady not because it's the most, it's probably the least what I call groundbreaking musical. I think it's truly one of the most brilliant musicals, but it wasn't groundbreaking in the way that Hair is, you know, or things like that, or indeed Hamilton is now. But it's absolutely a consummate work of art. It will always remain one of the greatest musicals ever written. But I love the characters. I mean, for me, I have to love the characters. I have to love the story, and the music has to support that. If the music is just, I can like music, but if I don't like the story it's telling, I won't do a show.
Right.
But
right.
I've always been driven by the storytelling.
I remember that myself. It's sort of the story has to come first. Story has to come first. And it is interesting that we can point back to the source material being all these fantastic writers.
I always remember wonderful quote of Claude Michel Schoenberg, you know, when we were endlessly rewriting Martin Gore. And Claude Michel said to me, you know, Cameron, if the story isn't there, I can piss music all day. But once I know exactly what the story is, I get it straight away.
Oh, boy, do I relate to that. It's so true. It's true. I can write a million of them. I can write a million of them. But if I don't know what's going on, it's just going to be junk, you know? If you could go back to that young man that just started out sweeping the stage of the Drury Lane, and you could tell him, you could give him some advice, what would you tell him today?
The one piece of advice when I was young, it was a book somebody gave me about a famous English impresario, was called Charles B. Cochrane. He was sort of the English version of Ziegfeld. I mean, it wasn't as big and flamboyant, but he was very well known and did the Cochrane Reviews and the Cochrane Girls, and he presented all the great shows of Noel Coward in the early days, and Beatrice Lilly and all these great stars, and he would produce in America as well. And in his autobiography, he cited that the only piece of advice he'd ever give aspiring producers, and that is, do something that you truly believe in, do it as well as you can. Do it for yourself, and then if you've done it well, hopefully the public will then also share your taste. And I went, you know, that makes sense to me, and that's always been what I believed. I've never gone with the public will like this, the public will like that. I never know what the public's going to like. Luckily, more times than not, they've liked what I've liked. I've always ensured that whatever the show I've done it to the best possible level, with the best working, with the best people. And, you know, if you don't like one of my shows, it isn't because it hasn't been well done.
You said you have to believe in it. What does that mean for you? What is required for you to believe in something?
Well, it's what I was saying earlier. It's about the subject. I have to fall in love with the subject and the story, because if I don't love the if I don't love the subject, and if I don't understand and more importantly relate to the characters, I can't possibly actually then push, prod, cajole, and all the other horrible things I do to you to get the characters written properly. I need to understand what it is you're trying to write, and I have to have an enthusiasm, you know, and throw in lots of bad ideas and occasional good ideas when something is missing. You know, and of course, I have been blessed with an ear that understands theatre music. You know, I instinctively relate to music that the place belongs on the stage. You know, and if I feel the music, you know, it can be very tuneful, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's theatre music. You know, I tune out on that, because unless the composer is also writing the story, you know, I'm not engaged. That's why there's very few operas I will go to, and not many ballets, because I'm not interested in the abstract. I'm interested in musicals because they tell a story. And, you know, I do, my idea of musical comedy is, you know, My Fair Lady or Mary Poppins, because, you know, they're real, they have a mess, they have a serious subject underneath it. You know, they're about something as well as being very entertaining. You know, I love Tits and Feathers as much as anybody, but they've got to come out of the story. You know,
indeed.
You know, and when I do, you know, I'm famous for doing shows with big scenery, but I also do shows with very little scenery. But you know, I only get out of the designer a big show if it's what I think the story requires. Much harder to do a show that's simple than it is big sometimes.
Right. It's a lot more challenging. And also, the thing that I'm hearing is that underneath it is something greater. Maybe something that affects one's life, their view on the world.
I mean, look, even a show like Avenue Q, which I didn't create, but friends of mine did. Mm-hmm. I loved Avenue Q. I adored doing it in London. And, you know, that is not a very big show. But it has tremendous heart and truth underneath its quirkiness.
Right, right. What is one of your proudest moments of a lifetime of proud moments? I can only imagine. Does one come up?
Well, I mean, I suppose. I mean, the highlights of my life obviously were the show that I didn't see the tryout of, but did take over the phone, simply because when somebody related to me that it only had three members of the cast, three stools, two grand pianos, and Ned Sherrin. When it was side by side by Sondheim, that review, I went, I'll do it, thinking the least I'll get with a Sondheim piece is good reviews, and it isn't going to cost me much. And of course, that wonderful show not only introduced London to the true brilliance of Steve, but also introduced me to Steve. And he's been one of my great friends in the theatre throughout my life. That is one of the great moments. Obviously, Andrew and I creating Cats, a show that everyone was absolutely sure was a complete and utterable disaster, and yet we both believed there was something there, and you know, that show then changed our lives. And then I suppose the third thing really was Les Miserables, which, you know, was for the first time an original musical, which I hadn't done with Andrew, and you know, I'd done on my own, and you know, and nobody thought that would work, and ended up being a success far beyond my wildest dreams. I never thought a show like that could ever become one of the most popular musicals of all time. It just didn't compute. And, you know, seeing that show come together and seeing what effect it had on an audience and still remains to this day is one of the miracles of my life.
It is amazing, isn't it? My goodness, life-changing for some people. I remember seeing it in London in the 80s, coming out and sitting on the steps of the palace, and I said, this is definitely what I want to do.
That show, more than anything else I've ever worked on, has brought more disparate people into the theatre. You know, both directors, performers, backstage, everything, you know. You know, Cats was incredible for bringing dancers into the theatre that would never normally come into the theatre and things like that. But Les Mis has brought, because it is really a dramatic piece, you know, has been an incredible catalyst for that. And, you know, I feel lucky to be alive to have seen another show, which is obviously Hamilton, that I go, there is a show that you know is going to be performed in 50 to 100 years' time if people still do musicals, and is going to have a wonderful influence on making people want to work in the theatre. You know, and they happen very rarely, and you never know when they're going to happen. And it is interesting that those kind of shows come out of the ether.
Right.
And they're unlike anything else that you'd expect could work.
Right. Fantastic. What a treat to always speak with you. Wisdom just kind of flies out of your mouth. I don't even think you know it sometimes. But
I don't. Yeah. Believe me, if I thought I had any wisdom, I'd bottle it. I'm very grateful I have any memory, never mind any wisdom.
Oh, it's fantastic. If there was one last thing you'd like to say this to someone who really, really has that bug, they really want to be part of the world of theater, they want to write, they want to act.
Listen, there's no mystique to it. You just have to throw yourself into it, try and discover what it is that you might be good at, and find out if you have a talent for it. You know, there's an awful lot of people who, you know, would like to be part of it. But, you know, I think if you want to, until you do it, you don't really know what you're good at. I mean, I know in my office over the years, you know, from all those years when I, you know, didn't know where the rent was coming from or I was going to pay anybody and anything like that. But, you know, the one by nature, you know, people were just thrown in to do this job or that job. And most of the people that have ended up helping me or really doing most of the work running my companies started off doing something completely different. And, you know, some drama would happen. And I go, oh, well, what's so-and-so doing? They can deal with it. And then suddenly you find someone has a talent for something that you never heard, you never thought of. And they make themselves indispensable. I think, actually, that's probably a very good piece of advice. Get into the theatre and make yourself indispensable, whatever it is. And in the process, hopefully find out what you're good at.
Outstanding. Outstanding advice. Yeah, Cameron McIntosh, you are indispensable. You have made such an impact on the world. You and also in my life, I just want to publicly say thank you. It's just incredible.
It's lovely to talk to you, and I'm delighted. And once we finish this conversation, we need to have a little talk about the witches coming out of the cauldron again.
Thank you, Cameron. Anytime. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
Side effects from listening to Take It From the Top include climbing out of a creative rut, getting inspired, and or living the life of your dreams. If these symptoms persist, tell a friend to download the podcast immediately.